You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today it's my pleasure to welcome Kelly Rigg. Kelly Rigg has been at the forefront of international environmental movements for years, for decades, three, in fact. She's led campaigns on climate change, energy transition, preserving Earth's oceans, and saving Antarctica. Working with Greenpeace on and off for 20 years, Rigg's role grew from campaign and project coordinator, focusing on wildlife and offshore drilling, to deputy campaigns director, where she developed projects centering on oceans, forests, and the Amazon. From 1986 to 1990, she led Greenpeace's successful worldwide movement to save Antarctica, combining policy change with field expeditions, helping establish a scientific base on the ice. Throughout her tenure, Rigg represented Greenpeace at the United Nations, always with a voice reminding the coalition about the state of the environment. In 2002, she led Greenpeace's campaign at the World Summit on Sustainable Development, highlighting climate change and renewable energy. In 2003, Rigg co-founded the Varda Group and serves as its director today. It's a consultancy association providing campaign and strategic advice to many non-governmental organizations. Well, so I read your resume. I mean, I read your bio, one of the many that's out there, and multiple decades. At the time, it was three. It's clearly four now.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah. And before we talk about those things, how did this happen? Like, where did it come from? Did you start as a little child?
No, you were a part of it, actually. You may not remember this, but So we were in San Francisco, and somebody sold you a button. It said Save the Whales and Greenpeace. Oh, yeah. And you were kind of interested in it. And at a point when I had left school because I had an illness that I needed to deal with, and I did it through sort of alternative medicine and dropped out of everything for a few years. And when I came back, I kind of remembered that Save the Whales thing. And when I went back to school, I kind of got interested in environmental issues, and I did my degree in environmental studies and became completely fascinated with Greenpeace. Mm-hmm. In that time. And I just knew that I wanted to go work for Greenpeace when I left school. Actually, that's not quite true. I was debating whether to go to law school first. Had a lot of friends who were in law school at the time, and thought about that. And my dad, for Christmas that year, my dad, who worked for Bechtel.
Yes, I remember
gave
that.
Me a briefcase, a boxy briefcase, as a gift. And I took one look at it and I thought, law school, Greenpeace, I'm going for Greenpeace. And so that was kind of this defining moment.
As I recall, you went to Boston.
Yeah.
You went to the Boston area and you started essentially door-to-door fundraising.
Door-to-door canvassing was kind of what gave me a little bit of an income to live off of until I got my first job. About 5 months later, I got a paid job.
With Greenpeace.
Yeah.
With Greenpeace. And I'm going to jump to the forward and then jump backwards. So you were with Greenpeace almost 20 years. Is that true or no?
Yeah. Yeah.
And why at one point you decided at some point to leave? Is there a reason? I'm not looking for dirt or anything. Like, did you suddenly feel like you could be more effective elsewhere?
And, you know, I'm one of these people that's extremely well organized and set up systems to deal with things. And then periodically, some of the more activist people say, this is just bureaucracy. Let's just throw all this out. And they throw it all out. And then everything would fall apart and descend into chaos for a while. And then somebody would say, we need a system. We need a planning system. And I'd say, I know what to do. And then I'd redesign it. And this was sort of about the third time we had gone through that. And I just thought, I just don't feel like doing this anymore. So I decided, and along with a couple of other Greenpeace people, we decided to just venture out and talk about the same sorts of things we did in Greenpeace, but for other groups, and try to help make other groups more effective if we could, that's what I've been doing now, the second 20 years of this 40-year career.
Right. With the group that you started, the Varda
group. Varda group, yeah.
Right.
Greenpeace is a way more complicated organization now than it was when I started. It's present in many, many, many more countries. And one of our strengths back in the beginning, in those early days, was one of the ways you break through all of the background noise is by painting things in very black and white pictures. You know, this is right, this is wrong. What you're doing is wrong. We are bearing witness to that. We are standing up for what is right. And suddenly, when you're a big international organization with offices in a lot of different countries, including some places that are quite complicated, things aren't always as black and white. And what may be black and white in one country, if you portray it that way, would do serious damage in another country. Mm-hmm. I'll just give you one example. You know, in the early days, you see people out, you know, harpooning whales, you get in between them and try to stop that from happening. Well, at some point when we had a Norwegian office, what we learned from the Norwegians was that every time we went against a Norwegian whaling operation, it set back the ability to phase it out many years, because you ended up getting the population screaming and yelling, protecting my country. They get all nationalistic about it. So suddenly you find out that, what you're doing may rile up the North American public or the British public or the Germans or the Dutch, but you're actually maybe creating some backlash in a country where you're trying to work with people to think about, you know, is this really necessary? Are there better ways to either earn income or get protein or whatever that is? And you let the next generation kind of, you know, phase that out. That's just one small example. I don't see it as a sellout. I see it as you're trying to achieve something, and direct action is one tool. And confronting, I still believe with all of my heart that killing whales is wrong. But I think that you have to start thinking about how you achieve change. And achieving change is not always as black and white and straightforward as you sometimes think it is. Now, for some people, that would probably be viewed as a sellout. For other people, you think it's just being more realistic. It's a hard call. It's a hard question. You do sometimes think, am I just getting older? Am I becoming less activist? But yeah, I don't know. I just think you have to look at the best way you're going to win.
Right.
I just want to say, though, I also don't want to give you the misconception that Greenpeace isn't doing action anymore. I mean, it does. It does things, a lot of things, in a national context, which is driven by a national campaign, for example, it's doing things, for example, you may have heard about what was called the Arctic 30 campaign, in which activists on one of the Greenpeace ships went and protested at an oil drilling rig belonging to the Russians, and they got taken and put into a Siberian prison for a little while, and it was touch and go whether they were going to get out again. So it's not like, that's not happening. It's just happening in different places. And I think the U.S. media is not always very
that was what I was
interested in reporting what Greenpeace does.
Right. Well, so, okay, 4 decades in that world, immersed in that world. How are we doing? We being, are things better? I don't mean is everybody, you know, sort of dancing through the flowers and we can all rest easily, but how are we doing?
Well, is the glass half empty or half full? I could
That's
say
what I'm asking.
There are lots of things in the glass, for sure. I ran a campaign to save Antarctica in the 1980s, and we won that in terms of trying to prevent the minerals development of the Antarctic, offshore oil and gas or mining for other minerals. That almost certainly would have happened had it not been for that campaign. Air quality is so much better, at least in many places, not everywhere, certainly not in many developing countries. But I mean, I was amazed. I was in Los Angeles recently, where I grew up, and the air wasn't, you know, flying into the city. It wasn't like this brown, dark layer of sludge you had to land into to get through it. So certain things have improved. Whales aren't being massacred in the numbers that they used to be. Small pockets of it still, but you know, some of them are coming back. The ozone hole is healing. That was a campaign that was amazingly quick, considering it involved an international agreement and the countries of the world came together in cooperation and actually made an agreement to, again, not everything is perfect in that regard, but massive, massive change. So there are a lot of success stories. That's the glass half full. The glass half empty, of course, is that climate change threatens to pretty much undo everything. And the loss of biodiversity, for example, as well. Those things are so big, in the too big to fail category. And, you know, who was it who said, you know, climate change is really an everything campaign? It's just, it involves everything. So, and we're not doing so well there. I mean, we're not doing as bad as we might have been had we not gotten agreements at the international level to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And some things are happening at the national level in some countries that are really making huge progress in that regard. But it's still a bit too little too late. And it's going to require a Herculean effort to bring that down to safe levels. We have the solutions. We know what to do. We know how to fix the problem. You know, it's really a question of implementing them at scale. I mean, you look at what's happening in Europe as a result of the Ukrainian war. There's a big gas pipeline, Nord Stream 2, which the Germans have been insisting for years and years and years it needs to go through, you know. Suddenly, within about a week's time, okay, we're stopping that. And now everybody's talking about banning imports of Russian oil and over time, Russian gas as well. I mean, that's when governments decide they're going to react as if there's a crisis, it's amazing how quickly things can change. I mean, there's problems with ramping up alternative sources to those Russian supplies in the short term. There may have to be some compromises in the short term, but it just goes to show you that when they decide there's a crisis, they will get it together really quickly. And why governments still, even those that are actively working to stop climate change, still act like we have more time than we do is just beyond me. I don't understand it. You know, in 1990 was when I first started campaigning on this issue. 1991, I was the campaign coordinator for Greenpeace for its atmosphere and energy campaign. We knew then what needed to be done. And if we had done it, if governments had taken it seriously, you know, we would have had a much slower, more leisurely transition than what we're looking at now. And, you know, I mean, even Margaret Thatcher has speeches back then saying that we have to do something about this. This was not like a big political football issue so much as it is today. So I feel like our generation really let the generations that are coming up now, we really let them down. Mm. And I feel, even though I know that I did everything I could in my power to make a difference, it's still hard not to feel bad about that.
Yeah. Question. So are you an optimist or a pessimist? I mean, how are you feeling about the world, where we are, where we're heading?
People say, you know, the best time to have taken action would have been 30 years ago, and the second best time to do it is now. And so I just keep feeling like you have to just still keep trying to make it less bad than it will be otherwise. First of all, I found that the best antidote to being freaked out about the whole thing was working on it. So that's one good thing. It desensitizes you a little bit. And then secondly, when I'm not in my work mode, I just try not to think about it. I really just try to put it in a little box and just think about, you know, I love to swim. I love to do photography, and I focus on the things that I like doing, family occasions, all of those things, and just put it in a little box. I think the one thing that it's important to remember is that as much as having individuals take action is important, you're not going to solve climate change through individual action. No. It has to be collective action. It has to be at the government level. There has to be, incentives and cost-effective solutions. Those are the things that are going to bring emissions down. You look at the pandemic, and everybody stopped flying. Everybody stayed home and whatever. Greenhouse gases didn't go down that much. You know, most greenhouse gases, I mean, it comes from industry. It comes from a lot of things that are a little bit outside of the control of individuals. Mm-hmm. So I find that I try to strike a balance between enjoying my life and but also being very conscious of it. And I do make sacrifices, but I also try to enjoy myself as well.
Yeah.
I can tell you in Amsterdam, I don't need a car. Don't own a car.
Own a car. Do you ever,
I recently had to acquire one in the U.S. for when I'm there at a big family. We have a family place. So it is, it was cheaper than renting one. But otherwise, I don't use a car. I don't own a car. I get everywhere by my bike, public transportation, trains, in town or whatever. If I absolutely need a car because I need to move something or whatever, I have a subscription. I log in online and reserve my car at, you know, like €3.50 an hour or something like that. And gas costs a fortune. Parking costs a fortune.
Yeah.
And getting around Amsterdam in a car is about the most inconvenient thing you can do, because you've got narrow streets that weren't built for, at least in the city center, aren't built for cars. And, you know, you get behind a garbage truck, you're screwed.
That's it. Goodbye.
And, or a delivery truck, and you just turn off your engine and sit and wait. You don't have people like honking and screaming so much, because that's just the reality. So owning a car, I mean, most of my friends own cars, I have to say, but a lot of them don't use it so often. You use it when you want to just go out to the beach or go out to someplace else. But I just don't.
Yeah,
basically.
Great. Good for you. Good for you. Can we sort of circle back? Can you talk about, or do you have any insight into, so the things you had to overcome kind of personally to go from Kelly Rigg, college student, you know, engaged human being in a whatever, to Kelly Rigg, activist, organizer, campaign leader, you know, I mean, I remember some of the stories of, you know, you're on a whaler with a bullhorn. And I don't mean a whaler like a whaling ship. I mean, like a Boston whaler or a
pontoon
boat, a Zodiac. That's not always an easy transition for somebody to imagine themselves doing. Did you have to somehow screw up your courage and do something, or did you go through a process? How'd you get from that perfectly lovely Kelly Rigg, that person way back then, to the person who was suddenly on the high seas doing things?
Well, it's interesting you asked that, because it's something that was one of the most profound experiences in my life, actually. You remember, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, you knew me when I had just at the tail end of this healing process, where I had an illness that medical profession was saying a lot of unpleasant things, and it was a bad choice to do what they said versus taking it into my own hands and going through this process. And somebody else you had on your show, Gary David, was a big part of that process in helping me through it. And one of the things that I learned, there came this moment where I was almost giving up in that process. And I had to really confront the fact that I had to take a big risk. Medical profession wanted me to have a surgery, a really bad surgery. And I had to say no and have faith that this was the right thing. And that was really hard. That was scary. I mean, you don't just go up when I was 20 years old. You don't go up against what all these doctors, I was at UCLA Medical Center, are telling you you have to do to survive. But I did it and it worked. And as I came out of that and I went back to school, and as I said, I started getting interested in Greenpeace, but I was doing environmental studies. I knew about a lot of different organizations and different approaches. And the thing that I realized was that what I had done on a micro level was to, I learned that things don't get better incrementally. You don't just gradually, slowly get better. You have healing crises. Things come to a big head, and then suddenly something changes and everything gets ripped apart. And then when it comes back together again, it's slightly different. And it involves taking risks and being willing to put yourself on the line in order to have this greater benefit. And when I looked around at a lot of environmental organizations at that time, what I mostly saw, or at least what I perceived, was incremental change processes. Let's lobby for this. Let's push for that. You know, we put out reports and we push this report and we do these things. And what I realized as I learned more about Greenpeace, there is a book called Warriors of the Rainbow by Robert Hunter, who's one of the founders. That book just completely changed my life. This notion of bearing witness and getting out there. And when you think all is lost, suddenly something magical happens, and being willing to take that risk. And suddenly everything changes in a very big way. It's not incremental. And that's when I decided I wanted to work for Greenpeace. And I started working. And at that time, it was very exciting if you got to do something on the ship. That was something you aspired to. You didn't automatically get to do that. And I was just this little person from Boston, just fresh out of college, part of this task force. And there was this guy who had been around longer than me, who'd written a proposal for this national campaign. And it was decided to fund it, but at a level that he didn't think was serious. So he said, screw it, I'm not doing it. So the campaign director at that time, who I'd never met in person, I'd just been on some calls, he said, well, you do it. I'm like, what do you mean, me do it? Yeah, you do it.
He said it to you.
He said, yeah, you seem smart. You run it. And I'm like, me? I was just suddenly like, holy shit, what's just happened to me? So suddenly I was put in charge of this campaign. And that involved the Rainbow Warrior was out in California. And the idea was there was a lease sale that was coming up. It's not like something you can put the boat in front of to stop, because it hasn't happened yet. You're trying to stop something before it happens. Right. So we decided to address seismic testing, which was the first step in the development, in the exploration process. First, they do all the seismic testing. They do this testing, and that's what the oil companies, they use that data to then decide if it's worth bidding on this or not. They make an assessment as to whether they think there's oil and gas down there. So we decided we were going to go out and block a seismic testing operation, which, by the way, do have bad side effects, for example, for whales and whatever. It's big blasts underwater isn't good for living creatures. So I went out to California about 6 weeks early because I was utterly terrified. And I just thought,
and it's your campaign.
It's my campaign. And I mean, there were people in the San Francisco office working on it. I was the national coordinator. But there was this reputation of the ship's crew eating alive office staff, you know. So I went out there 6 weeks early to prove myself. And I went out where the boat was in dry dock in Oakland. And on the weekends, I went out and just, worked. Talking, you asked me, working up the courage. So here I am, So what we did was, so when you're trailing a seismic testing array, you got about like something like a mile of equipment being towed. And if you stop suddenly, that array sinks and you've lost the equipment. So we put these people out, we call them the rubber duckies, these little boats, like little rubber boats, but not like the Zodiacs with the motors. We put them out there with no means of propelling themselves. Maybe there was a little oar in there, I don't know. But anyway, we just put them all out in front, way out in front from this. They were running transects.
With people.
With people. And then I got on the phone to this ship on the radio and told them what we were doing and said, you have to stop. And so far out in front that they would have time to roll up their gear before anybody got hurt. And the guy says to me, no, we can't do that. And I'm like, well, these people are out there. They have no way to move. So you're going to have to stop or veer off. And if they veered off, it would hurt their data because they were doing these. So we had this standoff. We were arguing back and forth. And every time I would say to him, well, da 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 da. And then I'd say over. And then I'd go, shit. Okay. Then, you know, and then go back on there and putting on my poker face. And he was, and then there were all these oil rig operators that were interrupting and just shouting obscene things at me, you know, trying to intimidate me. And I was just in this complete panic, but holding it together. The radio operator was probably laughing his head off, our radio operator. But finally, there came a point where the skipper of our boat, he says to me, tell him he can veer off. And he gave me coordinates because he's saying he can't stop. He can't veer off. And he goes, you know, he was saying he was like between a rock and a hard place. And Peter says, tell him he can go here. And so I told, and, you know, I told him that. And then finally the guy said, okay. And he did it. So we won the little campaign and I was all happy. And we made him go away and we made a big stink. And the lease sale didn't go ahead, as I recall, at least not. I don't know if it has since. There's, you know, all sorts of attempts to revive offshore oil drilling. But that wasn't even getting in front of a harpoon or something with somebody shooting at me. So yeah, I discovered though after that I'm really better at the office side of things than being out on a ship, really.
And is that essentially the work that you do now, is help people understand what it takes to do that?
Sometimes. I mean, since leaving Greenpeace, I did 2 5-year stints as coalition coordinators. So that was not only just sort of training and helping, that was active coordination. But I do sort of workshops and trainings. I mean, I think the really big thing people need to understand, which they often don't, it surprises me, what just kind of came naturally in Greenpeace was not obvious in other places always. I mean, some places was, but not always. And that is, you have to start by mapping the power in the situation. Who actually has the power to make the decision you want to have taken? You know, it may be this person nominally has the power, but they don't necessarily have the ability to do that. It's like saying, you know, Obama could put the healthcare system into, you know, he may, sure, you may right. think he's in charge of the country, but he wasn't entirely, right. you know? Right. So you have to really think who's holding the power. And then you have to think what's driving them, what influences them, who influences them, who's their base, who's their, you know, and how do you get at those people? And how do you get different messengers? You know, if Greenpeace is saying something, it may not appeal in the same way that some, mm-hmm. you know, Silicon Valley tech person saying it, right. just as an example. You have to really think and mapping those power dynamics, and then trying to think about where you can best intervene in a complex system where all of these things are happening. Where are the Achilles heels in the system? Where, if you intervene here, can you have a snowball effect? So you have to think where you can get more bang for your buck.
No, exactly. As you were talking, I had this image of, you know, so I'm not a skier, but periodically, periodically, I've gone to ski places, you know, the illusion of the bunny slope. and every morning you'd hear these blasts and you suddenly realize, like, at some point, you know, these are setting off detonations to avoid avalanche, right? But by placing the blasts in, You're not going to bring down this whole mountain by yourself. It takes too much stuff. But if you put it in the right place, you might be able to bring down what you need to bring down to do that. So
that's a very good analogy. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and that brings another facet of what I do. I'm really good at doing campaign evaluations when things screw up. You know, why did they screw up? Because I've seen all the possible ways things screw up.
Yeah.
And I'm very good at kind of diagnostics in that regard and seeing what's not working and why. And it's interesting. I'll tell you probably the number one thing I could point to about why things screw up is that not everybody understood the goal. Not everybody was working to the exact same goal. Because as you know, sometimes everybody fudges it to try to get to an agreement on something and you get this language that's a little bit soft so everybody can come away feeling they had something and everybody's working to that same quote unquote goal, but it's slightly different. And then suddenly things go seriously wrong in the middle of the heat of the action because I thought we were doing this. Well, I thought we were doing that. And they're at cross purposes. I've seen a lot over the years.
Yeah. You were on the ship that was, you had just been on the ship that was it the French ultimately?
Yeah, the French blew up. The Rainbow Warrior, yeah.
Rainbow Warrior, yeah.
And that same boat, my smokestack that I had needle gunned.
Yeah.
Got blown up in Auckland Harbor. Yeah. I was down there. There was this Pacific Peace Voyage that had been done over the last several months in the Pacific. The boat came into Auckland where it was getting ready, some change of crew and whatever, where it was about to go out on a flotilla out to Mururoa to protest French nuclear testing, the Mururoa Atoll. And well, as it turns out, the French put a spy in the Greenpeace office, like a, you know, proper serious spy for some bit of time, who she'd gone by then. And they apparently found this campaign to be a huge threat. And so I was there. I was on holiday, actually, on vacation. My boyfriend was the coordinator of that expedition, Steve Sawyer. And he, well, it was his 29th birthday. And we'd been in town and there had been, you know, just kind of a dinner party. And we were back on the boat. And yeah, it was kind of a party. And the crew gave him some presents and there was cake and stuff like that and drinking. And then down in the Rainbow Warrior was an old North Sea trawler and it had a fish hold and that had been converted into a theater for when people came on board, sort of an education place. And all the crew were down, not the crew, but the skippers for this flotilla were having a meeting down there. So Steve was down there and we needed to go somewhere else. There was a meeting of some of the trustees from the international organization meeting outside of the city starting the next day. And so I kind of prompted them to hurry up and finish because we needed to get going because somebody was driving us out there. And so we left. And then 15 minutes later, apparently, is when the first bomb went off. And yeah, if they'd still been down there, they would have all been killed because the water would have been rushing down. They wouldn't have been able to get back out.
My recollection is that some people were killed, right?
One person, yeah.
One person.
So the first bomb went off, and that was like where the engine room was on the side. And everybody was quickly...
These are bombs planted not by somebody who was the spy, but by people underwater.
Frogmen, yes. Right. Yes.
Like it was a real military operation.
Yeah, there were three different teams that carried out this operation, as it turned out. And... a couple of people went back down into the crew quarters. One went down because the cook had been down there sleeping and he wanted to get her out of there. Another one went down there because he thought his girlfriend might be down there. She wasn't. But as he was coming up, Fernando Pereira, who was the photographer, was coming down. And nobody knows what he was doing, but I can tell you as somebody who has photography as a hobby, when something is like that is happening and you are the ship's photographer, you're going to get your camera. To document it, to get pictures. And as he went down, the second bomb went off, which was right on the outside of the hull where the crew quarters were. So he was killed. But nobody knew yet. So we got a call. We were out about a 45-minute drive away, and we got a call several of us jumped in the car and went back to Auckland, you know, 45 minutes driving, not knowing if everyone was dead or, you know, what had happened. And yeah, it was a long night. We sat in the police station, which was kind of across the way from the wharf. And sometime in the towards morning, Fernando's body was found. And then over the course of the next few weeks, it was like being inside of a spy novel as one revelation after the next came out.
Was there some sort of a connect? Did the authorities in Australia, or New Zealand rather, know that the French were up to this? Was there some sort of collusion?
The UK government, there is strong evidence the UK government knew about it, and probably the US government knew about it. And Australia certainly screwed up the investigation, which makes you wonder what their part was. But no, New Zealand was outraged. You know. Yeah, it turned out that, there were three teams that did it. First was a boat, a private yacht with a crew that brought in the explosives. And then there was a team that a couple posing as a Swiss couple honeymooning. They were DGSE agents, military, I don't know, colonels or whatever. And they pretended to be on their honeymoon, driving the van down to Auckland with the explosives in it. And then there was a third team that were the frogmen who placed the bombs on the side. And then, air tanks, oxygen tanks washed ashore that said "Made in France" on them and things like that. It just became a bit ridiculous. Yeah. Eventually it all came out. The evidence was clear. There was an international arbitration between the French government and Greenpeace, and also between the French government and Fernando's family, both of which ended up with a sizable settlement. Fernando's family, it's not public what that was, but Greenpeace got, I think, something like $7 million from the French government for that, which was used for buying a new ship, amongst other things.
I was about to say, a new boat, right? A new Rainbow Warrior. And does the now new Rainbow Warrior, now old.
There's a third Rainbow, one.
Is there? Yeah, exactly. So there is still one.
Yes, there is a third one now, Rainbow Warrior 3, which is fully sail operated. It was built custom made. But one little footnote I have to tell you.
Yeah.
I can't tell you within maybe 2-3 years how many people, when I wasn't a canvasser anymore by then, but people who were canvassing, "Oh, Greenpeace, aren't you that organization that blew up that French ship?"
Oh, wow.
That became what people remembered. Yeah. That became a very common misunderstanding.
That's a little
adding insult to injury, literally.
Oh my God. Yeah. Is it still the case that there's that there's a sense that anybody who is an environmentalist is in the way of progress, is in the way of where the world needs to go? Why is it hard for environmentalists and environmental organizations to make the kind of progress they want to make? Is it simply people's lifestyles?
Do they want the glaciers to melt? Do they want the rainforest to get there? It's corruption. It's self-enrichment. It is enrichment of companies. It is, I don't even think it's down to, oh, well, we need development because we're concerned about the poor. I mean, that is true in some countries as well. You look at China, who gets a lot of blame for greenhouse gas, for somehow sabotaging climate negotiations, when in fact, China is one of the lower per capita emitters, and they're doing way more than many countries in terms of trying to do this transition. But at the same time, they've got a lot of people still in poverty. Mm-hmm. So you have differing realities in different countries. Do anybody want the glaciers to melt? I don't know. Maybe they're, if James Watt were still around, he probably wanted the glaciers to melt. I don't know. But I think for most people, in that situation that are perpetuating this, they either don't care or they think that it's all overblown. Some of them think that there will be a technological solution that will save the day. And, it's a complex question, but I think that, really, it's just there's a a long-standing communication strategy behind, certainly in the U.S., what the narrative that the oil companies have put out for many, many years. I mean, there's clear evidence. There's, you know, Freedom of Information Act documents. There's exposés. Exxon knew exactly what was happening for many years. There's a very cynical strategy to mislead the public, or there was in the past to mislead the public in the same way that the tobacco companies did. And, you know, I think, and then people get misled by that out in the public. I think for a lot of people who deny the reality of climate change, it's not so much if they start with they don't like the solution and then work their way back from there. We don't like what this solution means, and therefore the problem can't be real, as opposed to let's look at the science, here's the problem, and now how do we go about solving it? Mm-hmm. And I think really, it's become such a tribal issue.
But is it that way elsewhere?
I think so. I think the US is the worst. I mean, you look at the UK, and there's certainly, you know, tribalism there as well. But at the same time, the UK doesn't deny the problem of climate change. They just hosted the last climate conference in Glasgow in December, and they, you know, tried to accomplish a lot of good things. That's not to say that the UK government is doing everything right. They're not.
Right. Sure.
But there is tribalism. You definitely have the right wing constituencies there who are in denial and dismissive. You have it in Australia, for example. You have it in quite a number of countries as well.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of the time that I've worked on this issue constantly trying to think about how we make it not tribal. Is there a way to do it? I remember right after the big Copenhagen climate conference, I don't know how much that registered outside of climate circles, but there was a huge amount of hope that governments were going to get together and come up with a binding international agreement. Yes. And the whole thing fell apart.
Right.
And great despondence after that. And so in early 2010, we were just trying to think, okay, how do we regroup? What's the strategy going forward? And I remember reading this article, it might have been in the New Yorker or something, talking about this thing called the Tea Party. It's like, whoa, what's that? And I actually, in that very beginning, thought, you know, maybe this is what we need. These people, because at the beginning, the way it was described anyway, was that these people didn't like vested politics. They were into, you know, being much more pragmatic about getting things done and you know, doing things. And I thought, how can we get them on our side? You know, of course, that became very clearly that it was not.
How'd that work out?
Didn't work out so well. No, it became very clearly that it was created by the right. It wasn't something that just emerged as a genuine movement, as far as I understand it. But there was, for example, some years ago, I don't know what's happening with that now, but there was some Tea Party type groups in the southeastern US that were totally in favor of wind power. Because, you know, the Tea Party was really about, you know, was about tax and economic stuff. And wind power makes a whole lot of financial sense. And so they were like promoting this. And I was thinking, yeah, you need to have messengers who are not only people like me. You know, there's this thing, I forget what it's called, I'd have to look it up. I want to say cultural dynamics or whatever, where they've mapped all of these value senses, you know, and there's different people. And if you look at these different, I think there's 12 different value segmentations. And if you go to their website, you can do the test. And I used to, when I was running this coalition on climate, which was meant to be trying to bring in different constituencies and different voices and all of that, and everybody would just have these truths. And I would have them do that test. And literally every single one of us was in slice one of 12, all of us. There wasn't a single person who was in any of these other, you know, value categories. And you think, you know, this is why when we start trying to communicate based on what we think and feel and think is right and makes sense to us, it doesn't necessarily resonate with a lot of other people.
And in fact, and frequently, depending upon what the conversation is, it is just the opposite of resonating, right? I mean, it's just, It's they don't trust that person doesn't. And you know, you wish it were different, but there's a way in which, like, why should they trust you? Don't trust them, and they can feel it, right? I don't mean you, but right. So yeah, there's,
well, you know, there was a study. I've never read it. Somebody told me about it, but I've seen things which confirm to me that it's true. That they did this study, you know, like with the hotel towels, you know, if you drop them on the floor, that means you want them washed. If you hang them back up, it means you'll reuse your towels. And when they put up notes in the rooms saying this is good for the environment, you know, whatever, more people drop the towels on the floor than when you put up a note saying everyone else is doing this, most people hang up the towels again. There was this massive discrepancy in the numbers because most people don't want it. They want to do it because their neighbors are doing it or because everyone else is doing it, not because it's an environmental thing. The environmental thing can be a big turnoff.
Well, so yeah. Is there something else that you think is important to talk about that people should be thinking about that?
There are lots of things. One thing that's really big in the climate negotiations has to do with loss and damage. I mean, you've got a law background. You should understand this. What about countries that are poorer and have natural resources and are being told not to use them now because it's bad for the climate? We're all in this big boat together. And not only are they being told not to use them, but they're also suffering from heat waves and storms, and they don't have the resilience or capacity to protect their population. Who pays for that?
Right. Well, yes, exactly.
And where does that money come from?
That's the question. That's a kind of a question that when you ask that in a room, like a lot of people from the countries that have been doing the stuff that's damaging the world, they start taking incredible interest in their shoes. Like, who pays for that? Well, geez, look at that. They're like, not me. What do you mean?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's amazing to me that that in the instances where countries where under-resourced countries financially, that is, are actually considering, okay, you know, we want to do our part. We don't want to use those resources. So who's going to help? I mean, just the idea that they're open to that question, right, is amazing in and of itself. It's a commitment in and of itself, because yeah, wait, now you're telling me I can't do that? You've been doing that for 200 years. What do you mean I can't do that? I didn't do this. You did this.
Well, most of the rich governments don't want it on the agenda. It's been a big fight to even have the conversation.
Right.
And so that's becoming a pretty big thing. And of course, you know, the whole question at this point becomes adaptation. How do we adapt to the changing climate, and can we adapt? And what's that going to entail is another big question. I always felt, I mean, there was always a difference of opinion about if you talk about adaptation, does that somehow suggest you've given up on mitigation and we need to hold governments accountable and keep pushing for reduction in greenhouse gases? I always felt that if you looked at adaptation and what that really means, that would be one of your biggest selling points for mitigation. Because when you realize how hard it is and how expensive it is,
yes,
that, you know, mitigation looks like a much better option.
Yeah.
But that's really, you know, I live in the Netherlands. We're way below sea level. And, you know, it feels like on the one hand, a scary place to be. On the other hand, the Dutch have been managing water for centuries. And in fact, they send people out into the world to advise governments on how to do this. But there comes a point where, you know, if the entire Antarctic ice cap melts, you know, the kind of sea level rise we'd be talking about is probably even beyond the capabilities of the Dutch to manage. So, yeah, it's really, that adaptation question is going to get bigger and bigger, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's always occurred. I mean, it's always felt to me like it's important to have the adaptation conversation going on just quietly over here because otherwise it does sort of imply that, oh, all we have to do is adapt. Oh, good. Thank God. I don't have to change any of my behavior. I just have to learn to adapt to some of those problems. It's such a, it has such a benign feel to it because we're human beings. We're the most adaptable creature on the planet. Except
we're so technologically smart.
Yes, indeed. We can think our way out of anything.
Yeah. I loved that movie, Waterworld. Do you remember that one with Kevin Costner? Yeah. Everybody panned it and thought it was a horrible movie. I just thought it was great. It's like a little bit.
This is your life. Well, so say something as we come to a close. Say something that you're hopeful about.
Well, what's happening with the whole renewable energy scene is just so revolutionary. It's incredible. The speed at which we are developing technologies, it's astounding. And every time there's a scenario which predicts how much, for example, wind or solar we're going to have, it beats it by a long shot. So, and as I said earlier, when you look and see when governments finally decide to treat something as a crisis, it is amazing how quickly things can turn. And also, as I said earlier about that healing crisis I went through, change doesn't necessarily happen incrementally. And I think we are in a point of big crisis right now on a lot of levels. But I firmly believe that it is possible that there could be a very fast and abrupt change for the better in terms of action being taken.
Think that's super important to continue to point out. I mentioned my conversation with Bill Ayers, and in it was that reminder that, it happens that way on so many different fronts. And, the day before the students, young people from SNCC sat down in the lunchroom, in the luncheonette at the counter in the South, where they were not allowed to sit to be served, nobody would have expected it, right? I mean, the day before, everybody was just polite and in their place. The day before, Rosa Parks sat down in the bus. Who would have thought? And yet, just like that, not without struggle and not without effort and not without fight, but who would have thought? So I think that's super wise and true.
Yeah, and true. I mean, look at South Africa. Look how quickly once apartheid fell. Look, exactly. Look how that, I mean, it was a long, long struggle and fight and, Nelson Mandela sat in jail for 25 years, but suddenly a decision was made to change it and it happened.
Yeah, so, good things happening do not always make it into the news. But, and flying into Los Angeles is an incredibly different experience right now. Are there problems? Absolutely. There are so many problems. Yes. But there's ways in which, at least on some fronts in the world, things have never been this good. Which is not to say stop. Hope you don't stop.
I have no intention of stopping anytime soon, but I am 65 at this point. And I do believe.
How did you suddenly get older than me?
I'm not older than you. Never will be. You'll always have a few years on me. No, but I sort of feel like I think sometimes some of the young people would probably consider what I do to be a bit old school. And I think, that's fine. It's time for, I feel like my role is more to empower other people than to try to do it myself, because this generation has inherited this and they have to fight their way out of it.
But just that, just that insight that, maybe they had it, but maybe not, just that, look, it's important to make some noise, but making noise in the right places is even better. But, putting that charge where it needs to be.
Yeah.
So, Well, Kelly Rigg, thank you. Thank you so much for being willing to have this conversation and be curious together and reminiscing and.
No, it was fun. It was fun to talk to you. It's been a long time. And
yeah.
As I said, you were there at the very beginning. So
yeah,
now you
really,
see how it turned out.
A button. So now.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.